The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine, dated November 30th, 2012. As usual, we'll begin with the main story section of the week. Our first article is entitled, Israel and Hamas Agree to a Ceasefire. Here's what happened. Israel and the Palestinian militant group Hamas this past week agreed to a ceasefire after 8 days of bloody violence that saw Israel bombarded with hundreds of missiles and the Gaza Strip pounded by dozens of airstrikes. The deal, negotiated by the U.S. and Egypt, heads off a possible Israeli ground invasion of Gaza and calls for Israel to stop all hostilities and targeted assassinations in the Gaza Strip and for all Palestinian factions to stop launching attacks from the territory. If the truce holds, it will serve as the foundation for negotiations over a broader, more durable peace deal that could include an easing of Israel's blockade of Gaza. This is a critical moment for the region, said U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who announced the deal in Cairo alongside Egypt's Foreign Minister Mohamed Ammar. The people of this region deserve the chance to live in peace. The agreement came after days of Israeli air assaults on missile launching sites, munitions dumps, smuggling tunnels, and government buildings inside Gaza. Medical officials said that at least 144 Palestinians, more than half of them civilians, died in the attacks. Over the same period, militants inside the Gaza Strip fired at least 1,400 rockets into Israel, killing 4 civilians and 1 soldier. A suspected Palestinian terrorist also threw a bomb into an Israeli bus, injuring 22 people. Now here's what the editorial said. Hamas bears the responsibility for this pointless conflict, said the New York Times. The Islamist group is so consumed with hatred for Israel that it has repeatedly resorted to violence, no matter the cost to its own people. Gaza militants fired between 750 and 800 rockets into Israel this year before Israel finally retaliated last week by assassinating Hamas's military mastermind Ahmed al-Jabari and launching its air campaign. Thankfully, Israel's Iron Dome missile defense helped blunt the militants' aggression, said the Wall Street Journal. The high-tech interceptor system, largely paid for by the U.S., took out almost 90% of the missiles aimed at populated areas. Iron Dome not only saved lives, it provided more time for military and political leaders to decide how to respond. If missiles had been constantly landing in Israeli cities, a full ground invasion would have quickly followed. Now here's what the columnist said. Don't expect this peace deal to last, said Brett Stevens in the Wall Street Journal. Every time the Jewish state has extended its hand to the Palestinians in Gaza, it has been bitten. Israel's 2005 withdrawal of security forces and another peace deal in 2008 yielded a Palestinian regime even more radical and emboldened than it had been before. So long as Hamas stays in power, Israel can expect many reruns of this same sordid show. If Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu really wants to hurt Hamas, he should attack it politically, said Peter Beinart in thedailybeast.com. That means seriously negotiating with Hamas's rival, Palestinian Authority President Mohamed Abbas, who believes that forging a deal with Israel is more likely to bring his people dignity and justice than are Hamas's rockets. But it's hard for Abbas to convince Palestinians to pursue a nonviolent path to statehood when Netanyahu keeps permitting expanded Israeli settlements in the West Bank. Israel could also undermine Hamas by ending its crippling blockade of Gaza, said Robert Wright in TheAtlantic.com. Unemployment has soared to over 40% since Israeli sanctions were implemented in 2006. So it's no surprise that many desperate, jobless young men have decided to take up arms with the militants. Hamas isn't going away anytime soon, says James Kitfield in NationalJournal.com. In the wake of the Arab Spring, Islamist governments are openly allying themselves with Hamas's radicals rather than with Abbas's more secular Palestinian Authority. Over the past week, Hamas has received outpourings of diplomatic support from officials in Egypt, Qatar, Turkey, and Tunisia. Unless Israel can empower and make peace with moderate Palestinians, the region's growing Islamic solidarity may leave it increasingly isolated and ensnared in a perpetual cycle of tactical skirmishes with an ever more potent opposition. The next item from the main story section is entitled, Obama Enters the Asian Fray. President Obama promoted his Pacific Pivot strategy this past week on a four-day trip to a region increasingly unsettled by China's growing influence. Obama's visit was the first by a U.S. president to Cambodia, which hosted a summit of the Association of Southeastern Nations, Asian Nations, and to Myanmar, where he met with Nobel Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi and praised the country's flickers of progress toward democracy. In a delicate statement at the ASEAN summit, Obama urged all countries in the region to resolve their deepening territorial disputes over uninhabited islands that are claimed by China and by others, including American allies Japan and the Philippines. But the summit ended in acrimony as Cambodia, a Chinese ally, sought to forestall efforts to set up an international system for resolving those disputes. It's no surprise the summit turned testy, said Melinda Liu in TheDailyBeast.com. U.S. allies in the region are nervous. The backdrop for these simmering frictions is China's inexorable rise, America's scramble to remain a major player in the Pacific, and the shifting power balance between these two. Obama wouldn't say it openly, but his administration's diplomatic outreach and new military deployments are all about encircling China. He's moving too fast, said Joshua Kurzlantic in The New Republic. Repressive Myanmar is nowhere near deserving of U.S. recognition, yet Obama rushed to embrace it. Thailand and Laos are little better. The militaries of all three countries have been accused of summary executions and crackdowns on ethnic minorities, yet all three benefit from Pentagon ties as buffers against Chinese influence. We should be wary of compromising our support for fledgling democratic movements to back these regimes, which may bring no strategic benefits to the U.S. Obama is proving a master of cynical realpolitik, said Michael Hirsch in NationalJournal.com. The president he most resembles right now on foreign policy is Richard Nixon. Only instead of opening China to defy the Soviets, he's opening Myanmar to outmaneuver the Chinese. It is definitely not a pretty tactic, but it may work. We can at least hope that the short-term sacrifice of human rights for a longer-term triumph of American influence in the region eventually results in more democracy as well. The next item from the main story section here at home, tax rates and the fiscal cliff. Negotiations to avoid the fiscal cliff got off to a rocky start this past week, with congressional staffers and White House negotiators expressing pessimism that they could agree on a deal before the end of the year. Despite conciliatory rhetoric last week, both from congressional Republicans and from President Obama, the two sides remain far apart on how to avoid the large tax increases and across-the-board spending cuts that are set to begin on January 1st. House Speaker John Boehner said Republicans remained opposed to raising tax rates on wealthy Americans, but would be open to raising additional revenue through closing tax loopholes. Obama continued to press for a higher tax rate on top earners, a measure he said would generate $1.6 trillion more revenue over the next 10 years and help close the deficit. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke urged the two sides to strike a deal to protect the fragile economy. "The stakes are high," he said. The president still has the upper hand, said David Frum in the DailyBeast.com, and he figures he can use it to pressure Republicans into yielding on their no-tax pledge. But Republicans should play for time. Obama will never again be stronger than he is this month. He doesn't want to risk the economy relapsing into recession, so the longer the GOP stalls, the better deal it will get. Obama is right in saying that the math doesn't add up on the GOP's proposal, said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com. Capping tax deductions at, say, $17,000 per family might raise $1 trillion, but not only would that kill philanthropy and hobble the housing sector, it's just not enough. Raising the top tax rate is the only idealistic, or rather the only realistic way to get the revenue. Republicans will concede on taxes only if they get major entitlement reform, said Ramesh Ponnuru in Bloomberg.com. They have real leverage in arguing that we can only reduce the deficit by slowing the growth of Social Security and Medicare spending. Alas, Democrats will never let Obama agree to such a deal. Gridlock is on the way, followed by competitive finger-pointing. Now we'll turn to the controversy of the week from the main story section. It's entitled, Benghazi, Will It Be Obama's Watergate? The deadly attack on the U.S. consulate in Libya may not have cost President Obama re-election, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post, but it will surely cast a dark shadow over his second term. In the days after the September 11th attack that claimed the lives of Ambassador Chris Stevens and three others, Obama administration officials, including UN Ambassador Susan Rice and the president himself, misled Americans by insisting that the attack on the consulate in Benghazi had grown out of a spontaneous demonstration over an anti-Islam video. This, we now know, was a monstrous lie designed to keep Obama's anti-terrorism credentials intact during the final phase of a close election. Former CIA Director David Petraeus testified before Congress last week that intelligence officials knew from the start that the attack was the work of Ansar al-Sharia, a local terrorist group affiliated with al-Qaeda. Yet somehow the White House's talking points were edited to blame the attack on unspecified extremists. Good news, said Kevin Drum in MotherJones.com. This non-scandal's big mystery has been solved. Director of National Intelligence James Clapper said this week that the public talking points on Benghazi were edited by the intelligence community, not the White House. A reference to al-Qaeda was changed to extremists so as not to tip off a specific terrorist group that the CIA had sources in Benghazi and was on its trail. Not that it matters. The Benghazi conspiracy theory has been absurd from the start, since it's premised on the notion that President Obama's re-election somehow depended on the public believing it was extremists who killed our diplomats, not terrorists. There's only one explanation for how deranged the right has become over what it is portraying as possibly the greatest crime in the history of the U.S. government, said Paul Waldman in Prospect.org. Scandal envy. Republicans are furious that Obama has yet to be tarnished by a major scandal like Iran-Contra or Watergate, and a Benghazi gate is their desperate attempt to rectify the situation, even if there's no there there. The scandal is quite real, said Victor Hansen in NationalReview.com. The biggest question is why our government rebuffed Stevens' request for more security before the attack and failed to provide military assistance during it, leading to the preventable murder of four brave Americans. As for why the White House might want to downplay the terrorism angle, said Peter Brooks in the New York Post, it's pretty obvious. The full truth would have undermined Obama's claim to have al-Qaeda on the run, and shattered the notion that we're on the verge of a new and improved Middle East and North Africa, the result of Team Obama's deft diplomacy. The full truth about the attack is still unknown, said Eric Wimple in WashingtonPost.com. My CIA sources say there is no evidence that al-Qaeda was directly involved in the attack. Instead, some of the attackers may have been supporters of radical Islam with tenuous links to a local terrorist group affiliated with al-Qaeda. Supporters or terrorists, involvement or links, much of this debate hinges on subtle matters of semantics. Something obviously went wrong in Benghazi, said Andrew Rosenthal in the New York Times, and Republicans are right to demand answers, but missteps don't always add up to a scandal, and confusion after the fact doesn't necessarily constitute a cover-up. Now, from the main story section, we'll turn to the popular column, A Good Week For and A Bad Week For. It was a good week for extraterrestrial rumors after NASA scientists said that the Curiosity rover on Mars had made a discovery for the history books that will be withheld until it's double-checked. The speculation is that Curiosity found organic compounds, the building blocks of life, in the Martian soil. It was a good week for preemptive strikes after a kamikaze turkey sent a message to carnivores in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, 5 days before Thanksgiving by flying into a power line and knocking out power for 1,500 people. And it was a good week for having no conscience after guard Jack Taylor of Grinnell College in Iowa set a new college basketball scoring record with 138 points in his team's 179-104 victory over Faith Baptist Bible. Taylor chucked up 108 shots, including 71 three-point attempts. And it was a bad week for Rupert Murdoch after the media baron wondered on Twitter, why is Jewish Open Press so consistently anti-Israel in every crisis? He later tweeted, apologize unreservedly. It was a bad week for nativity scenes after Pope Benedict XVI says in his new book that there were no oxen, donkeys, or other animals at Jesus' birth. The Pope also says the entire Christian calendar is based on a 6th century monk's miscalculation of when Jesus was born. It was a bad week for birther jokes after the Helena Independent Record, a Montana newspaper, printed a story with the line, Obama was allegedly born in Hawaii. A copy editor added the word allegedly as a joke, thinking that the other copy editor would catch it, and editor's note later explained he didn't. Now we'll turn to the briefing section in the Week magazine. Our briefing article for this week is marijuana bad for you? As the legalization of pot marches on, the health consequences of smoking it are hotly contested as ever. How does marijuana get users high? When marijuana is smoked or eaten, a chemical called tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, is absorbed into the bloodstream, activating proteins in the user's brain and spinal cord. This produces short-term psychoactive effects, including euphoria, a heightened state of awareness, and a sharp appetite. It's a high many Americans enjoy. 1 in 3 admits to having tried marijuana, and 5 million use it almost every day. Already allowed for medical use in 18 states, marijuana has just been legalized for recreational use in Colorado and Washington State. But even as pot moves toward mainstream acceptance, questions persist about its long-term effects on the mind and body. We know surprisingly little about marijuana, given its widespread use, said Jonathan Calkins, a policy expert at Carnegie Mellon University. Hasn't pot always been considered harmful? Not at all. Marijuana, the dried form of the plant Cannabis sativa, was used as an herbal remedy for centuries in China, the Middle East, and Asia. William O'Shaughnessy, a physician for the East India Tea Company, brought it west in the 1830s as a treatment for rheumatism, tetanus, and rabies. It was commonly prescribed as a pain reliever in the United States until the 1930s, when its growing popularity caused such concern that the newly founded Federal Bureau of Narcotics reclassified it as a narcotic. The Bureau soon launched a decidedly unscientific campaign claiming that marijuana use provoked insanity, homicidal tendencies, and uncontrollable lust. The marijuana user, the Bureau asserted, becomes a fiend with savage or caveman tendencies. His sex desires are aroused and some of the most horrible crimes result. Was there any evidence for such claims? None, in fact. The American Medical Association argued against marijuana prohibition in the 1930s, citing its therapeutic potential. But the Bureau made its case that marijuana was dangerous for the mind and the body, and the federal government outlawed its use in 1937. It wasn't until the 1970s that a campaign began to restore marijuana's therapeutic reputation. And in 1996, California became the first state to legalize cannabis for medicinal purposes. Psychiatrist Todd Mercuria, a founding father in the medical marijuana movement, claimed that cannabis has none of the adverse side effects of opiates. In fact, he said it really enhances both quality of life and rehabilitation. Does the research bear that out? We don't have as good data as we have for alcohol, but the evidence is already clear, said Susan Weiss, policy chief for the National Institute of Drug Abuse. Marijuana is not good for you. Frequent prolonged marijuana use has been linked to depression, psychosis, anxiety, and other mental disorders, especially among teenagers. A decades-long study in New Zealand found that adolescents who used pot at least four times a week lost an average of 8 IQ points between the ages of 13 and 38. Studies suggest that about 9% of all users become dependent on marijuana, and that pot smokers have far higher rates of workplace injuries and school absences than non-users. One study of 46,000 Swedish soldiers found that even infrequent pot smokers were more than twice as likely to develop schizophrenia as non-smokers. Regular users were six times as likely. Fred Gardner of the California Cannabis Medical Research Group says the National Institute on Drug Abuse looks for the negative stuff on purpose and disregards anything positive about cannabis. And no study has proved a causal link between marijuana use and neurological disease. What positive effects can it have? An Institute of Medicine study in 1999 found that marijuana provided modestly effective relief for nerve pain, stimulated appetite for people with AIDS, and helped chemotherapy patients control nausea and vomiting. But there's no evidence that marijuana works better than other therapies, and anti-drug advocates argue that the overwhelming majority of medical users aren't really sick. In Colorado, just 3% of the state's 104,000 medical marijuana users are cancer sufferers, and 94% say they use it to relieve pain, which is notoriously hard to verify. Most medical marijuana recipients are drug abusers who are either faking or exaggerating their problems, said addiction psychiatrist Ed Gogic. Why is marijuana's impact so unsettled? Because ever since the battle over marijuana prohibition began in the 1930s, both sides have argued that their case is more with politics than with solid science. Particularly in the early years, anti-drug crusaders demonized pot as a narcotic and wildly overstated its effects. Since then, its advocates have cavalierly dismissed any suggestion of negative side effects as pro-establishment ideology. Part of the problem is that published research into marijuana's physiological effects is woefully limited. A 2009 review by the AMA found fewer than 20 legitimate clinical trials of marijuana use in the U.S., involving a total of just 300 people. That's because the Drug Enforcement Administration routinely refuses to grant universities and pharmaceutical companies permission to research marijuana use. The new laws in Colorado and Washington might allow researchers to gather substantive proof of marijuana's harms and benefits. It's an empirical question, said Rosalie Licardo-Pakula, director of the Drug Policy Research Center at the RAND Corporation, and we'll finally have data to assess it. And now the footnote for this briefing article about marijuana. Not Your Daddy's Reefer is the headline. Those who smoked weed in college a generation ago might find a toke or two of today's product enough to knock them all the way back to the summer of love. Whereas traditional marijuana contained around 1% of the active ingredient THC, experts say today's weed contains up to 10%. The emergence of bioengineered crops and novel medicinal marijuana strains means that marijuana is no longer what it used to be in the 1970s and early 1980s, said Dr. Delphine Sikoyos, a researcher at Texas A&M University. But others counter that memories have become foggy and that traditional pot was a lot stronger than people now say it was. 1% is not smokable. That's really industrial hemp, said marijuana reform advocate Keith Stroop. All you get from that is a headache. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for this week, November 30th, 2012. Thanks so much for joining me today. We'll turn now to the best columns in the U.S., according to the Week magazine for this week. Our first one is entitled, Subsidizing Shoreline Foolishness. The editorial appeared in USA Today. After a horrific disaster like Hurricane Sandy, it's natural to want to do everything possible to help people struggling to rebuild their homes, businesses, and lives, said USA Today. Those good intentions, however, can lead to a lot of foolish and even dangerous decisions. In shoreline communities up and down the East Coast, people are now vowing to rebuild homes, vacation getaways, and businesses that the storm inundated and swept away like so many matchsticks. The National Flood Insurance Program, which is already $17.8 billion in debt to taxpayers, faces 100,000 new claims from Sandy, with payouts expected to total $7 billion or more. Chances that the money will be repaid to taxpayers, virtually nil. A 2010 study by this newspaper, USA Today, found nearly 20,000 shoreline properties where multiple insurance claims had produced payouts greater than the property's value, including one Mississippi home flooded 34 times over 30 years. Owning property on the shore has an inherent risk, a risk that seems to be growing as sea levels rise and storms become more powerful. Taxpayers shouldn't be asked to subsidize those who build castles at the ocean's edge. The next column is entitled, Seduced by the Illusion of Privacy, by Frank Bruni in the New York Times. You'd think by now it would be screamingly obvious that there's no true dependable privacy when we're tapping or typing, said Frank Bruni. Yet General David Petraeus, like Representative Anthony Weiner, Tiger Woods, and so many others before them, has fallen prey to the greatest contradiction of contemporary life: how safe we feel at our touchpads and keyboards versus how exposed and imperiled we really are. When we send a text or an email, we imagine ourselves a protected and anonymous cocoon. No one seems to be watching, so with a reckless velocity, we express anger, share gossip and criticism, or indulge in flirtations and sex talk we've never put into words in person or even on the phone. Who hasn't said something in an email about a friend, colleague, or boss that, if revealed to the world, would cause great embarrassment or even the loss of a job or a marriage? We succumb to this temptation for the same reason Petraeus and the other fallen stars did. That glowing and treacherous screen in front of you is somehow the greenest light of all. And the next article is A Prescription for GOP Revival. This editorial was written by Brett Stevens in the Wall Street Journal. A few months ago, said Brett Stevens, I angered fellow conservatives by predicting that the GOP would lose the election. Now that this has come true, let me explain why our party seems so angry and extreme to millions of Americans. First of all, we need to stop obsessing about what other adults might be doing in their bedrooms. Trying to control other people's private behavior is creepy, and if gay people want to get married and live traditional middle-class lives, well, that may be lunacy on their part, but it's a credit to our values. Republicans also need to come into the mainstream on abortion. Most Americans support sensible restrictions, but they're alarmed when pious culture warriors say abortion should be banned even in cases of rape and incest. And can we please stop sneering at Hispanic immigrants? If the argument is that Hispanics don't share our values, then hard work, religiosity, and a strong sense of family are no longer American values. So get a grip, Republicans. It's time to get out of the echo chamber and engage with America as it really is. And now we will flip back to the back of the magazine here in the Week magazine for this week to the last word. And this particular last word column is entitled Close Encounters with Mark Twain. In Rudyard Kipling, says Craig Brown, Twain found an admirer. In Helen Keller, he felt the presence of God. In 1889, Rudyard Kipling is 23 years old, though he looks closer to 40. He arrives in San Francisco on May 28th after a 20-day voyage from Japan. He is greedy for life. He witnesses a gunfight in Chinatown, lands a 12-pound salmon in Oregon, meets cowboys in Montana, is appalled by Chicago, and falls in love with his future wife in Beaver, North Pennsylvania. Before he leaves the United States, he is determined to meet his hero, Mark Twain. He goes on a wild goose chase to Buffalo, then Toronto, then Boston, before tracking him down to Elmira, New York, in June, where a policeman tells him he spotted Twain, or someone very like him, driving a buggy through town the day before. He lives out yonder at East Hill, 3 miles from here. At East Hill, he is informed that Twain is downtown at the home of his brother-in-law, General Charles J. Langdon. He finds the house and rings the doorbell, but then has second thoughts. It occurred to me for the first time that Mark Twain might possibly have other engagements than the entertainment of escaped lunatics from India. He is led into a big, dark drawing room. There, in a huge chair, he finds the 53-year-old author of Tom Sawyer with a mane of grizzled hair, a brown mustache covering a mouth as delicate as a woman's, a strong, square handshaking mind, and the slowest, calmest, levelest voice in all the world. I was shaking his hand. I was smoking his cigar, and I was hearing him talk. This man I had learned to love and admire 14,000 miles away. Kipling is transfixed. That was a moment to be remembered. The landing of a 12-pound salmon was nothing to it. I had hooked Mark Twain, and he was treating me as though, under certain circumstances, I might be an equal. The two men discuss the difficulties of copyright before moving on to Twain's work. Growing bold and feeling that I had a few hundred thousand folk at my back, I demanded whether Tom Sawyer married Judge Thatcher's daughter and whether he were ever going to hear of Tom Sawyer as a man. Twain gets up, fills his pipe, and paces the room in his bedroom slippers. I haven't decided. I have a notion of writing the sequel to Tom Sawyer in two ways. In one, I would make him rise to great honor and go to Congress, and in the other, I should hang him. Then the friends and enemies of the book could take their choice. Kipling raises a voice of protest. To him, Tom Sawyer is real. "Oh, he is real," says Twain. "He's all the boys that I have known or recollect, but that would be a good way of ending the book, because when you come to think of it, neither religion, training, nor education avails anything against the force of circumstances that drive a man. Suppose we took the next 24 years of Tom Sawyer's life and gave a little joggle to the circumstances that controlled him. He would, logically and according to the joggle, turn out a rip or an angel." Twain laughs. They move on to autobiography. "I believe it is impossible for a man to tell the truth about himself, or to avoid impressing the reader with the truth about himself," Twain says. "I made an experiment once. I got a friend of mine, a man painfully given to speak the truth on all occasions, a man who wouldn't dream of telling a lie, and I made him write his autobiography for his own amusement and mine. Good, honest man that he was, in every single detail of his life that I knew about, he turned out, on paper, a formidable liar. He could not help himself." Twain talks of the books he likes to read. "I never cared for fiction or storybooks. What I like to read about are facts and statistics of any kind. If they are only facts about the raising of radishes, they interest me. Just now, for instance, before you came in, I was reading an article about mathematics, perfectly pure mathematics. My own knowledge of mathematics stops at 12 times 12. But I enjoyed that article immensely. I didn't understand a word of it, but facts, or what a man believes are facts, are always delightful." After 2 hours, the interview comes to an end. The great man who never minds talking assures his disciple that he has not interrupted him in the least. 17 years on, Rudyard Kipling is world famous. Twain grows nostalgic for the time he spent in his company. "I believe that he knew more than any person I had met before, and he knew I knew less than any person he had met before. When he was gone, Mr. Langdon wanted to know about my visitor. I said, he is a stranger to me, but is a most remarkable man, and I am the other one. Between us, we cover all knowledge. He knows all that can be known, and I know the rest." Twain, now age 70, is addicted to Kipling's works. He rereads Kim every year, "and in this way I go back to India without fatigue. I am not acquainted with my own books, but I know Kipling's books. They never grow pale to me, they keep their color, and they are always fresh." The worshipped has become the worshipper. As Helen Keller's carriage draws up between the huge granite pillars of Mark Twain's house in Stormfield, Connecticut, the most venerable author in America is there to greet her, though he can neither see him, or rather, she can neither see him nor hear him. Her companion, Annie Sullivan, her eyes and ears, tells Helen that she is all in white, his beautiful white hair glistening in the afternoon sunshine like the snow spray on gray stones. It is February 1909. Twain and Keller first met 15 years ago when he was 58 and she was just 14. Struck deaf and blind by meningitis at the age of 18 months, Helen had, through sheer force of will, discovered a way to communicate. She finds out what people are saying by placing her fingers on their lips, throat, and nose, or by having Annie transpose it onto the palm of her hand in letters of the alphabet. Taken up as a prodigy by the great and the good, she formed a special friendship with Twain. "The instant I clasped his hand in mine, I knew that he was my friend. He made me laugh and feel thoroughly happy by telling some good stories which I read from his lips. He knew with keen and sure intuition many things about me and how it felt to be blind and not to keep up with the swift ones, things that others learn slowly or not at all. He never embarrassed me by saying how terrible it is not to see or how dull life must be, lived always in the dark. Unlike other people, Twain never patronized her. He never made me feel that my opinions were worthless, as so many people do. He knew that we do not think with eyes and ears, and that our capacity for thought is not measured by five senses. He kept me always in mind while he talked, and he treated me like a competent human being. That is why I loved him. For his part, Twain is in awe. She is fellow to Caesar, Alexander, Napoleon, Homer, Shakespeare, and the rest of the immortals. She will be as famous 1,000 years from now as she is today. Shortly after their first meeting, Twain formed a circle to fund her education at Radcliffe College, which led to her publishing an autobiography at the age of 22, which in turn led her to become almost as celebrated as Twain himself. But the intervening years have struck Twain some heavy blows. One of his daughters, Susie, has died of meningitis, another of an epileptic fit in a bathtub, and his wife, Livy, has died of heart disease. Throughout Helen's stay, he acts his familiar, bluff, entertaining old self, but she senses the deep sadness within. There was about him the air of one who had suffered greatly. Whenever I touched his face, his expression was sad, even when he was telling a funny story. He smiled, not with the mouth, but with his mind, a gesture of the soul rather than of the face. But for the moment, he welcomes them into the house for tea and buttered toast by the fire. Then he shows them around. They go upstairs to see his bedroom. Try to picture Helen, what we are seeing out of these windows. We are high up on a snow-covered hill. Beyond our dense spruce and fir woods, other snow-clad hills and stone walls intersecting the landscape everywhere, and over all the white wizardry of winter. It is a delight, this wild, free, fir-scented place. He shows the two women to their suite. On the mantelpiece there's a card telling burglars where to find everything of value. There has recently been a burglary, Twain explains, and this notice will ensure that any future intruders do not bother to disturb him. Over dinner, Twain holds forth, his talk fragrant with tobacco and flamboyant with profanity. Dinner comes to an end, but his talk continues around the fire, says Helen. He seemed to have absorbed all America into himself. The great Mississippi River seemed forever flowing, flowing through his speech, through the shadowless white sands of thought. His voice seemed to say, like the river, "Why hurry? Eternity is long. The ocean can wait." Before Helen leaves Stormfield, Twain is more solemn. "I am very lonely sometimes when I sit by the fire after my friends have departed. My thoughts trail away into the past. I think of Livy and Susie, and I seem to be fumbling in the dark folds of confused dreams." As she says goodbye, Helen wonders if they will ever meet again. Once more, her intuition proves right. Twain dies the following year. Sometime later, Helen returns to where the old house once stood. It is burned down with only a charred chimney still standing. She turns her unseeing eyes to the view he once described to her, and at that moment feels someone coming toward her. "I reached out and a red geranium blossom met my touch. The leaves of the plant were covered with ashes, and even the sturdy stalk had been partly broken off by a chip of falling plaster. But there was the bright flower smiling at me out of the ashes. I thought it said to me, 'Please don't grieve.'" She plants the geranium in a sunny corner of her garden. "It always seems to say the same thing to me, 'Please don't grieve.' But I grieve nonetheless." And that was from an article called "Hello, Goodbye, Hello" by Craig Brown. and was copyrighted in 2011, printed by permission of Simon & Schuster, Incorporated. And now we shall turn to the health and science section from the Week magazine for this week. Our first article is entitled, Are Humans Getting Dumber? As a species, we're not as smart as we used to be. That's the theory of a Stanford University researcher who believes that human intelligence started to decline when civilization made life easier and allowed dimmer individuals to survive and pass on their genes. I would wager that if an average citizen from Athens of 1000 BC were to appear suddenly among us, he or she would be among the brightest and most intellectually alive of our colleagues and companions, Stanford geneticist Gerald Crabtree tells The Independent in the UK. He figures human beings reached their intellectual peak 2 to 6,000 years ago, when life was so harsh and individualistic that bad judgment generally led to death. Farming progressively led to denser communities where people could collectively ensure one another's welfare. As a result, evolutionary pressure, the hunt for prey, the avoidance of predators, no longer culls the slow-witted the way it once did. A hunter-gatherer who did not correctly conceive a solution to providing food or shelter probably died, Crabtree says, whereas a modern Wall Street executive that made a similar conceptual mistake would receive a substantial bonus and be a more attractive mate. Clearly, extreme selection is a thing of the past. The next article is Meditation's Health Benefits. Meditating, the practice of sitting quietly and clearing the mind of all thoughts, could dramatically improve heart health, a new long-term study suggests. Researchers divided 200 adults with heart disease into two groups. One group was taught to meditate for 20 minutes twice a day. The other group was encouraged to spend a similar amount of time exercising and preparing healthy meals. After nearly a decade, researchers found that those who had meditated for the recommended time had reduced their risk of heart attack and stroke by 66% compared with those who had not. The risk for those who meditated only 8 times per week dropped by nearly 50%. The meditators also reduced their blood pressure and reported feeling better able to control their anger. What this is saying is that mind-body interventions can have an effect as big as conventional medications, study author Robert Schneider, director of the Institute for Natural Medicine and Prevention, tells WebMD.com. Indeed, previous studies have shown that meditation can do a whole host of positive things, reduce anger and stress, encourage happiness, says cardiologist Michael Shapiro. But, he adds, researchers still don't know how it really works. And our final article from the Health and Science section today is the Health Scare of the Week, Flu and Pregnancy and Autism. Women who contract the flu or run a fever while pregnant may bear children with a much higher risk of autism than their peers. Danish researchers collected data from 97,000 expectant women and found that those who experienced a bout of flu were twice as likely as women who didn't to have their child diagnosed with autism by age 3. Women who had a fever for more than a week were 3 times as likely to have an autistic child. Catching a cold or developing respiratory infections, however, didn't seem to have any effect on autism risk. The findings are one piece of the very important puzzle to figuring out autism, Colleen Boyle of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention tells USA Today. About 1 in 88 American children and 1 in 54 boys has the disorder, which researchers think is caused by a combination of environmental and genetic factors. It's still unclear whether fever and flu during pregnancy play a casual role, but Boyle urges caution. It's flu season, she says, and pregnant women should get vaccinated immediately. And now we'll turn to the Talking Points section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first article here is entitled, "The Secretary of State, Is Rice Right for That Job?" "The last thing Susan Rice deserves is a promotion," said Jeffrey Taylor in Politico.com. President Obama seems determined to nominate the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. to succeed Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, even though Rice recently flat-out misled the American people about the Benghazi terrorist attacks. In the days after the deadly al-Qaeda-led assault on the U.S. consulate in that Libyan city, Rice repeatedly characterized the attacks as a spontaneous riot triggered by an anti-Islamic video made in the U.S. She was either naively passing on a cover-up created by the White House or knowingly hiding the truth about what everyone now admits was a planned terrorist assault. Republicans are now in full rebellion at the prospect of a Rice nomination, with Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham vowing to filibuster it in the Senate, and 97 House members writing to Obama to say she has caused irreparable damage to her credibility, both at home and around the world. "Actually, Rice is more than qualified for this job," said Joan Walsh in Salon.com. "She's a Rhodes Scholar and a gifted diplomat who, as U.N. ambassador, succeeded in the almost impossible task of getting the world to back tougher sanctions on Iran. There's absolutely no evidence that she did anything wrong on Benghazi. In fact, it's now clear that she based her early statements on talking points handed to her by the intelligence agencies. The other rap on Rice, surfacing in unattributed quotes, is that she's brusque and aggressive and can grate on both colleagues and foreign diplomats. Successful, ambitious women always face this sort of criticism. And in case anyone hasn't noticed, while the Secretary of State needs diplomatic skills, the job of negotiating with Russia, China, Iran et al. Doesn't require a doormat." Both Obama and Senate Republicans now must make a high-stakes political calculation, said J. Newton Small in Time.com. "If Obama nominates Rice, Republicans will use her hearings to examine whether Obama dropped the ball in Benghazi and thus cost four Americans their lives. Rice, meanwhile, will be forced to testify under oath as to what she knew about terrorist involvement. And when she knew it. Republicans face a different problem. They just got clobbered in an election because they alienated women and minorities. If McCain et al. Now gang up on Rice, do they really want the image of old white guys hectoring an African-American woman?" And the next article here is, "Racist Tweets, Should Teens Pay the Price?" After President Obama was reelected, the young racist came out in force, said Tracy Egan Morrissey in Jezebel.com. On Facebook and Twitter, there was an eruption of racially loaded hate speech from high school and college students who proudly posted their names, faces, and even school affiliations. "No nigger should lead this country," tweeted a football player from Xavierian High School in Brooklyn. A student at University Christian School in Jacksonville, Florida, wrote, "Did you hear the bad news? The monkey is staying for another 4 years." These dumb posts will probably haunt these kids for the rest of their lives, said Kashmir Hill in Forbes.com. That's because Jezebel.com decided to publish dozens of names and photos alongside the racist tweets and posts. These words will now be preserved indefinitely in cyberspace and will show up if college admission officers or potential employers do a Google search on their names. "This is the world we live in, kids. Stupid offhand remarks at 16 may mean you don't get a job at 26. "Young people say stupid things all the time," said Katie Waldman in Slate.com. "They act impulsively, try on roles and test boundaries, mostly to impress their friends. For a self-righteous website to shame these stupid kids publicly and damage their futures is petty and vindictive. I doubt that this kind of public shaming will make the students reconsider their views," said Emily Bazelon, also in Slate.com. "If you're attacked and punished for saying something that you thought only a few friends would hear, wouldn't you feel anger more than remorse?" Most teenagers have no real idea how exposed they are on social media sites, and companies like Facebook and Tumblr, which profit from constant sharing, have made a cold calculation not to remind them. Teenagers understand very well how the Internet works, said Mac Buchanan and BuzzFeed.com. Real names and faces have always been the currency of social media. And since more and more of our lives are lived online, it is no longer some separate space where you get to adopt a persona without responsibility. The accepted rules and sensibilities of society now govern our conduct there as well. Using racist or sexist insults or making threats is very likely to bring negative consequences. If you don't know that already, you certainly should know it. And a couple of short articles here as we reach the end of our program for this week. America now has more computer software engineers than farmers. More than 1 million people are trying to make a living writing apps and other software. Army suicides have hit a record high, with 166 active duty soldiers suspected of taking their own lives so far this year. The problem has grown so severe that the Army ordered a service-wide stand-down in September, requiring soldiers to put aside their usual duties and discuss suicide prevention. And now we'll take a look at the poll watch for this week from The Week magazine. 65% of Americans believe President Obama will make a sincere effort to compromise with Republicans and create bipartisan solutions to the nation's problems. 48% say they think congressional Republicans will be willing to compromise as well. And 57% of Americans say Israel is justified in taking military action in Gaza. 25% say that the action is really unjustified. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week magazine. Be sure to join me again next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next week.